Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Sabbath services for a number of people who are joining us today. Appreciate everybody being here. Look forward to tomorrow to enjoy a very special day as well. Tomorrow's Father's Day, as probably all of you know. It's a day to honor dads, as we've often said. Last month, we talked about moms. We talked about spiritual mothering, if you remember. So today I would like to take a little bit of time to speak about the topic of simply restoring the fatherhood of God. Now that may seem like a strange title, but I think as we get into the sermon today, restoring the fatherhood of God becomes something very important at this time in the history of the church. Jesus made a statement. We don't need to turn there right now, but if you want to write it down in your notes, it's John chapter 1 and verse 18. These following words were stated, "No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, He has declared Him." But how? But how? Let's examine that particular question today, because we are told by Jesus again in the book of Matthew chapter 11 that there is the one to whom the Father wills to have revealed through the Son His relationship with man. That God has intended that as God our Father, Jesus Christ would be the one who would reveal Him to us. One of Jesus' responsibilities while on earth was to reveal the fatherhood of God. Why? Because God is a family. Now I'd like you to turn with me to the book of Malachi. Let's begin there in the book of Malachi this afternoon and look at a scripture that is stated in Malachi. You've read it many times. We're going to look at it and amplify it in the discussion today in the sermon. But it tells us here in Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, he says, "Behold, I send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and the dreadful day of the Lord. And he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers." Now, there are two meanings to this particular section. One is definitely there would be a relationship that would be taught from the scriptures about fathers and mothers, marriage, and that sort of thing. But the second thing is that you would have the hearts of the children of Israel turned back to the truth of God. And so he says in verse 6, he said, "Lest I come and strike the earth with," as it has in the Masoretic text, "with total destruction." So Malachi tells us something else. It tells us that the world is going to become so corrupt in breaking God's law of family that unless Elijah were to come and restore the government of God on this earth, God would destroy this earth with total destruction. That's what the scripture says as we evaluate it. But there's one more scripture I'd like you to turn to as we look at this particular topic today, and that's 1 Corinthians chapter 15. This is the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, beginning in verse 24. We read something very important because we recognize while Christ revealed God as our Father, while Christ showed us the relationship that we can have with Him, Jesus also told us in chapter 15 and verse 24 through the Apostle Paul the following: "Then comes the end when He delivers the kingdom of God to the Father, when He puts an end to all rule and all authority and power, for He, Christ, must reign until He has put all enemies under His feet." So we recognize the final, shall we say, act by Jesus Christ will be to deliver the kingdom of God to the Father. And after all the deception has been put away on this earth, as the Father comes down to spend that time after the time of the new heavens and the new earth. So again, we see this relationship of the fatherhood of God with His family for all eternity. So let's evaluate this from one particular point of view this afternoon, and that is asking the question, what is a father? What is a father? Well, we would say, number one, he's a provider. I'm speaking of that in the Church of God. We would say, secondly, that he's a disciplinarian. But we also find, number three, that he's a fixer of broken appliances. He's a fixer of cars. He's a fixer of toys. And he's also a fixer of hearts as well. He also, number four, is a planner. And hopefully, at times within all of this, a source of fun. Sometimes having to be tough, but hopefully with humor and imagination in a balance. As we talk about it, this is what we are looking forward to trying to imitate in that relationship. So, where do we find good fathers? Where do we find good examples of fathers? Well, I think if you look down the aisle where you're sitting, you probably will see one. Just look down the aisle and you probably will see one. Why here? Why in this particular group of people? Why in the Church of God? Because fathers here are beginning to understand God's way and God's priorities. And so today we want to again evaluate and spotlight those ways and those priorities. They have the potential to be the best fathers. Why? Because the best father is God. Because the best father is God. And husbands and fathers are trying to emulate God as father. I think as we look at that example, it becomes extremely important for us in God's church at this time. Now, God has given many roles to others. Christ as a son, Christ as a husband to the church as mother, and the church as wife as well. But God has reserved for himself the role of the father. He has reserved that role for himself. He gives it to no one else because there is something unique about that role. So let's examine that role. Let's look at some of the positives. Let's look at some of the negatives this afternoon and see if we can be a little bit more productive in that job. I describe this in my specific purpose statement as simply, father should equal family. Father should equal family. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean? Not just procreation, because cats can do that. But we recognize that Guinness Book of Records tells me that there was a 100-year-old sultan who had 888 kids. Can you imagine his investment in Pampers? Unbelievable. I doubt you could call him a father, maybe a sire, if we may be so blunt in that particular regard. But the point is that we see that fathers should equal family. Now, good or bad, we all came from a family. Good or bad, we all came from a family. And most importantly, as we have entered into the Church of God, we are a part of God's family. So let's ask the question, how is the father's role assigned? By God. Nobody else but by God. The male was designed for the job by God, not popular vote. How important is the father's role? Well, let's take a look at some history today and see where we are in this 21st century as a result of hearing the history of what's going on in our country. History shows the life of societies without a father in charge. Listen to what Straight Talk by James Dobson says. I want to read just one paragraph out of this, but I think it's profound because it tells you something you need to know. Dr. Charles Winnick at City University of New York studied more than 2,000 cultures that have existed in world history. He found 55 where masculinity and femininity were blurred. He said not one of the unisex societies survived for more than a few years. Not one of the unisex societies survived for more than a few years. Why not? Because society can be no stronger than the vitality of its families. And its families are a function of the way the sexes relate to each other. Maleness and femaleness are not merely social niceties that have evolved through time, Winnick said. While customs vary from one culture to another, he simply said, the linkage between the sexes is a function of powerful forces deep within the human spirit. He goes on to say that attraction must not be tampered with by social engineers with an agenda of their own. George Gilder, in his book entitled Sexual Suicide, said, that with the disintegration of the family, the male without proper family environment constitutes a leading social problem. Now, these are all things that are out there you can read for yourself. They started writing about this in the 90s, and it moved into the 2000s, and these are things that you can pick up at any of the bookstores if you want to look at them. George Gilder made this particular statement. John Hinckley's parents, under the advice of John Jr.'s psychotherapist, gave him $100, drove him to the airport, and sent him on his way. At John's trial, the father broke down in tears and said, "I am the cause of John's tragedy. We forced him out at a time when he just could not cope. I wish to God I could trade places with him right now." That's an interesting realization, but too late. Irma Bombeck, I don't know whether you read any of her writing. She's not an Ann Landers. She's not an Abby, Dear Abby. She's not Carolyn Hacks, but she does deal with the situation of a society, and she's a syndicated writer who a few years ago died of breast cancer. But she was very witty. She was very pithy in the things that she was able to say. But she talked about in a Father's Day column about the pain that she had over her father's death. And she said she was haunted by the memory of her father who died when she was only 9 years of age. And she said simply she didn't know why it still hurt, even in her age of being married and having a family. So you begin to understand the importance of something that sometimes you don't always look at. She talked about her father as always being there, and, you know, you didn't really know anything about him. I think, let me see if I have a quote from her about him. Yes, it simply said that she talked about the fact that my father left the house every morning, and he always seemed glad to see everybody at night. He did important things like open jars of pickles when no one else could. She said he was only one in the house who wasn't afraid to go into the basement by himself. You might understand that. He cut himself shaving, but no one kissed it or got excited about it. But what do we do with our kids, right? I mean, just an exact opposite thing. And, of course, he signed his report card, took lots of pictures, but he was never in any of them. I thought that was very, very interesting. And she said, "I was afraid of everybody else's dad, but not my own. I once made him tea. It was only sugar water, but he sat on a small chair." You might understand that if you had those little small tables and chairs in your house. And it said, it was only sugar water, and he sat on the small chair and said it was delicious. But he looked so uncomfortable. She said that whenever I played house, the mother doll had a lot to do, but never knew what the daddy doll had to do. So she talked about that, and I think it was interesting that every year she would talk about her ambivalent feelings because she saw a broken home. And I think George Gilder in his book on sexual suicide said the very same thing. The disintegration of the family, whether it might be the way it is today or what it might have been by death, simply shows us some interesting pains that did occur. So how does God look at fathers? Let's take a look at that today. He looks at them as being responsible. He looks at them as being responsible for their families. Where did God go first when Adam and Eve sinned? He went first to Adam. Then he went to Eve, and then he went to the serpent. So I think we want to look at that first and foremost. Let's go over to 1 Samuel chapter 2. It's a story about Eli. You know the story, but let's rehearse it again. I think it's very important that we understand how God felt about a man who was to run his church in Israel. He was there to run his church in Israel. This is 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 22. 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 22. Talks about, "And Eli was very old, and he heard everything his sons did to Israel and how they lay with the women who assemble at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. And he," that is Eli, "said to them, 'Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil doings from all the people.' He said, 'No, my sons, it is not a good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people to transgress. If one man sins against the other, God will judge him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who will intercede for him? Nevertheless, they did not heed the voice of their father because the Lord desired to kill them." Dropping down to verse 29, it says, Why do you kick at my sacrifice and my offering which I have commanded in my dwelling place, and honor your sons more than me? So he didn't do something about the problem. And make yourselves fat with the best of the offerings of the children, the offerings of Israel, my people. Then verse 34 and verse 35. Now this shall be a sign to you that will come upon your two sons, on Hophni and Phinehas. In one day they shall die, both of them. Then I will raise up myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind, and I will build him a sure house, and he shall walk before me anointed forever. And of course, we know what happened in that particular case. But it showed that Eli was accountable for his son's action. So coming back to how God looks at fathers, we are responsible. We are to take on that responsibility and to work with it. And so God dealt with the father Eli and his involvement in the Old Testament church, and he did not save his family. He did not save his family. So let's look for a moment at the qualities God expects in fathers. Let's look at a scripture that sometimes is misunderstood. It's found in 1 Timothy chapter 3. We're doing a little bit of foundational material here in the sermon to begin with. This is 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4. Notice what it tells us about the man who desires the job or the office of a bishop. He desires a good work. Talks about him being blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, sober, etc., not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but gentle, not quarrelsome or covetous. Verse 4, one who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. I have watched the misuse of this scripture for years. I will tell you from this pulpit that there is a certain misunderstanding that had come when the church years ago was authoritarian in its approach to some things. And it does not say what some people think it says. Verse 12 also talks about deacons, in which it says, let the deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own house well. I decided to do something for you today. I went back to what we used to teach in ABC, in the Epistles of Paul class. I want to share just a couple of Greek words with you. I'm not going to make it real technical for you, but I want to take the words that rules well his own household and some of the things about his family being in subjection. I won't read the Greek words. I'll just simply tell you what they basically mean. It says, well, seemingly beautiful. These are the words that have to do with ruling well your own house. He goes on to say, in an absolute sense, right and excellent. The word is used from the Greek, handsome, gracious, fair to look upon, that which commands love and admiration, that which is useful and honorable and pleasant and appropriate. These are all definitions of the Greek word. So what we did was we amplified that by going to some of the commentaries and that, and listen to what the commentaries said as they looked at this particular Greek word. They uphold the value of each family member. They uphold the value of each family member. Secondly, they create and maintain a pleasant, positive, encouraging atmosphere within the family. I thought that was an interesting one. Consistent in approach. Consistent in approach. They said non-threatening. Everybody in the family feels valued. These are all of the things they drew from the Greek words as they put together a concept about ruling well his own household, having his children in subjection. I thought it was interesting. Listen to another one. It says, appreciates the value of family, encourages each member to uphold family standards, to lock arms, you know, to uphold each other and to be one in that sense of the word, just as God the Father is one with Jesus Christ, just as God the Father and Jesus Christ are one with his church, and the feeling that you have with God the Father of being one with him, and again, they're all a part of that thinking. And then he goes on to say, in again, one last definition that they pulled out, public with praise, private with criticism. Isn't that interesting? Public with praise and private with criticism. Look, stop for just a minute. We think only in terms of authority as a result of our programming from the past. I know that. I stood at the pulpit and taught it for years. But what I didn't understand was the broadness of the concept of authority. We have to talk about leadership. We have to talk about communication. We have to talk about mercy. We have to talk about teaching, guidance, example in word and deed. This is what we recognize is a part of it. Let me tell you again. Leadership, communication, mercy, teaching, guidance, example in word and deed. This is what God the Father has given. This is what He has given in Jesus Christ. This is what Jesus Christ is teaching us in the church. This is what the church is to teach husbands. Now, what does all of this mean? You know, people say, well, probably we can think one of the big things that Dad might be able to do is bench press 250 pounds. That's big stuff. Or maybe he solves quadratic formulas without paper and pencil. Or maybe he earns $200,000 a year. Probably none of them. Probably none of the above. But when you go back to look at 1 Timothy 3 and verse 4 and 5, you begin to realize how important the broadness of this office, if I may use that term, is. Because it's not just authority. It has to do with leadership, communication, mercy is a part of that, and teaching, guidance, and an example in word and deed. I can tell you that a father's job never stops all the way through with his children, all the way through their life as well. So it's not just for one short period of 18 or 20 years, but it's a lifelong thing. What are some of the key elements to being a good father? Just some that I wrote down. He loved his wife, and he loved his children. Now, you may ask this question, why is that so important? Well, we'll see in a moment. He's not a marshmallow. He's simply not a marshmallow. He's principled. He's fair-minded with a touch of wisdom. He's fair-minded. That becomes a very important thing, a balanced approach. He's hardworking. He shows leadership without domineering. Notice my word. Said he shows leadership without domineering. Dominating is different from domineering. Okay? Now, let's go to Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. We see one other interesting thing here in the book of Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. It tells us, and you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. When you look at this concept, it simply tells you that you should be finding the ability to be balanced and flexible. It tells you that you need to work with your children from their youngest age all the way up until you spring them, and even then, I don't think you really quite let them go in that sense of the word. So we talk about the importance of bringing them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. So there's training, there's example, all of those things. And you find out that's very important. Now, as you grow up, you learn that you have to see some things that maybe you went through in your life, okay? I see things that I went through in my life. Now, my dad is bigger than I am. I don't know how I ended up being smaller, but he was bigger, he was broader. I used to say that when he walked through a doorway, you know, a door frame, he covered the whole thing. I mean, he was a pretty big individual. Now, I made a big mistake when I was small. Big mistake. I used to watch my father. He used to do plumbing. He did carpentry work. One time, he took his 2 weeks vacation and he repainted his old 46 Hudson. Now, why you'd ever want to redo that car and it being a Hudson, only the Lord knows. Because my dad did, and he took 2 weeks, and he was very good at all of those things. So when the kids would say to me, ah, my dad does this, my dad does that, I said, no, not my dad. I said, my dad can do anything. And he said, oh, come on, Richard, come on. And so I came home one day and I told my dad that. We were having dinner and we were sitting there and I said, they were asking, what can my dad do? And I said, I told him my dad can do everything. He can do anything. And did I get chewed out? My dad looked at me and said, don't you ever say that. Now, my dad's got a big booming voice. You have to understand that he bellows. Italians, when they get going, you have to understand. Be around Dave and Delicato and you will understand that. They have this big, strong, bellowing voice. By the way, it was a good sermonette today. We'll keep you for another week after that one. But we really did. I mean, my dad was just too loud. Everything was always at high decibel all the time in his life. But, I mean, he just chewed me out, something awful. Well, never forgot that. So as you get older as a kid, as your father is a figure, a male figure, you're growing up, and one of the things you wanted to do is to be able to beat him at something. And so I got into high school and we started bowling. And we enjoyed the bowling and I ended up working toward what they call American Junior Bowling Congress, in which you have classic league bowling which goes beyond a certain point. And I was bowling 175 average as a 16-year-old kid. Now, that was pretty good at that time. I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm just simply saying I will be whittled down to size tonight when I get home if I do get too cocky about that sort of thing. But my dad said to me one day, he said, huh, you know, he just goes after me and says, you know, come on, Richard, come on. You're not really that good. He said, I'm going to take you bowling. And I said, now's my chance to get him back for all these times. You know, because as a kid grows older, he gets a little bit more aggressive with his dad. So we went down to the bowling alley that evening. Started out, my dad went right over the foul line. He slid right through the foul line, and he lost that particular frame. And I'm saying, this is getting better all the time. The second time he fell down on the second frame, he fell down, and I'm saying, this is going to be easy, like falling off a log. Well, it didn't quite happen that way. He started to string the strikes. Third, fourth, fifth, and I'm saying, what's wrong with this old man? He's not supposed to be doing this. And sure enough, he won the first game. Well, that had to be luck, I'm sure. There was no way he's going to do it again. He beat me the second game. And he beat me the third game. And as we drove home in the car, I was quiet as a church mouse. And never said another word. But the realization was that, you know, as a male, I was trying to do certain things to beat him. But later I found out that the older he got, the smarter he got. You ever notice that? Dads sometimes they kind of get a little more mature. They get a little bit smarter as they get up around 40 and then 45. And I just began to realize he was getting smarter all the time. But the only problem was that I was becoming older and I was maturing. And the older I became, the more I began to realize great qualities, you know, and that sort of thing. So you find it most interesting to see how you learn to deal with your father. Now, of course, he had some bad years in the last part of his life, but the point was that you realize that what you said when you were a kid really had meaning later on. You know, my father can do anything. And I think that was really a truism with him. Now, we read of the righteous and wonderful works of a woman. We read about the wonderful works of a wife. We read about a mother found in Proverbs 31. Is there a chapter to give us the biblical example of a real man? Think about that for a moment. Is there a chapter in the Bible that gives us an example of a real man? I think so. Let's go to it. Proverbs 29. Proverbs, the 29th chapter. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Job. Job 29. I'm sorry. I went the wrong place. I was thinking of going to the women's chapter. This is Job 29. I'm not going to read all of it, but it's a beautiful chapter. Many, many, many examples here. But in this particular chapter 29, it gives us an example to work with and to parallel in our lives as fathers and as husbands. Because Job was both a man of character And he had a family for whom and before whom he set an example. But notice these things. I mean, these are lofty principles. But he said in verse 2, "Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God watched over me." And he talked about how God did back years ago. And he said in verse 7, let's begin in that part, "When I went out to the gate by the city, when I took my seat in the open square," meaning he was with the elders of the city, "the young men saw me and hid. And the aged arose and stood." So there was a certain respect for this particular man for all that he had become. And he goes on to say, "The princes refrained from talking, and they put their hands on their mouth." That is, they listened rather than try to give their opinions on a number of things. Going on, he said, verse 12, "Because I delivered the poor who cried out, the fatherless and the one who had no helper, the blessing of a perishing man came upon me," in verse 13, "and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy." Verse 14, "I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban." Verse 15, "I was eyes to the blind and I was feet to the lame." So it meant that he must have been doing things with people. Goes on to say in verse 16, "I was a father to the poor and I searched out the case that I did not know." Verse 21, I don't want to take the whole chapter, but just parts of it. "Men listened to me and waited and kept silent for my counsel. After my words, they did not speak again, and my speech settled on them as dew." And then verse 25, he said, "I chose the way for them and sat as chief, so I dwelt as a king in the army, as one who comforts the mourners." I thought that was a very interesting concept that we see. So when you look at Proverbs 31, then add to that, if you would, Job 29, because there were examples in here that you can read slowly and draw probably a good 15 or 20 principles that you could apply. Let's ask another question. Should fathers be the link to the outside world? Should fathers be the link to the outside world? I ask that because I read in a book entitled Father, the Figure and the Force. It's by Christopher P. Anderson. Listen to what he says. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs out of it, but I think it's a very interesting statement that Christopher Anderson says or makes. "We experience a vague sense of embarrassment when we are asked how we feel about our fathers," says Harvard psychiatrist Michael McCobe, the author of the best-selling book Gamesman. "Mother represents love." That's true. Mother represents love. "Father is the model for the outside world," he says, "the prototypical stranger that we as children must prove ourselves to. When we are first toilet trained, daddy is the first outsider before whom we proudly display our newfound talent." Now, I won't go any further, but I could tell you some interesting stories from my house. But I will leave it at that. "You can always express love for your mother, but your father represents accomplishment. When we become adults, we feel that we are not independent if we haven't cut the ties that bind us to today." There's another role fathers play that may heighten tensions even long after we have left the nest. "A two-year-old must express emotions in a way that is not overly destructive," says McCobe. "Wrestling and roughhousing with dad provide the first healthy outlet," sometimes, notice the word I'm going to use now, "for aggression." He said, "Hardly an auspicious start to one of the most important relationships in our lives." Now, in growing up with my son, I found one of the things that he always wanted to do was to play games. Friday night, we had this hallway, and we played what we call stick hockey. We got down, and we had a little goal. And we had a marble, and we had a 12-inch ruler, which we tried to get the marble past the other one's goal. And he was as strong to do that as he was to play ping pong against me, as he was to play racquetball, because he wanted to be able to show himself as being able to accomplish. But more than that, there is a male aggression with males. It's a positive thing you have to understand. Now, I wrestled with my son many, many times. I used to wrestle with my grandchildren, and I would nicely roll them off the bed as I wrestled with them. But with my son, it got more and more as we grew older, we wrestled. In fact, it got to be an interesting problem that Mom just let out a holler because we would bang furniture and chairs and all kinds of things got in the way. And the older we got, the tougher it got. So my kid went to college and he started lifting the weights and he built up the muscles. He did really a good job in doing that. And he worked out with the weights and beating his dad in wrestling was going to be a big thing. So he came home after his first year of college and we went around that living room and we went around that dining room and banging things and Mama was screaming at us, you know, please stop this, you're ruining everything that I've got. And we wrestled to a draw. We wrestled to a draw. And he came back to me a little bit later and he said, Dad, let's wrestle again. I said, not on your life. I will break your finger before I let you wrestle with me again. And he laughed and he says, oh, you know. And I said, no, we wrestled to a draw. And to this day, I will never again wrestle him. Now, why is that important? Why is that important? Because I think as our children moved to their teens, I think we saw that males with males had to do that. I had a friend in Canada, a minister. His name was Terry. And he was a minister from the States, and he came up to work in Canada. And he's telling me the story about boxing with his dad. His dad would get down on his knees, and he would box with Terry. They both put on gloves. And they would go at it, and, you know, just boxing and trying to give each other a good workout. And Terry said that he started to spar with his dad until one day, he said, I became really very aggressive, and I decided to really pound on him. And I was really going to go after him. He said, I was really trying to lay it on him. And he said, I got halfway through the bout with him. And he said, this right cross came right through my guard. And he hit me on the chin. And he said, Richard, I saw stars as I lay there. And I said, what happened, Terry? He said, I never tried it again. But the point was that I think, you know, he had to simply go through those things. So I think it's interesting to see the part that sometimes fathers can play as their children are growing up. Now, not just boys, but we'll talk about girls in a minute. CNN made a comment one day, and it caught my attention. They said this, in a study of 850 families, it was noted among these families with a father as a presence that confidence and self-esteem was noticeably higher and the acquiring of knowledge seemed as well at a higher level with those children. Now, let's understand, it can be done without. That's not what I'm saying in the sermon. I'm just simply showing you that in that particular study that there was a greater presence of confidence and self-esteem and a higher acquiring of knowledge because there seemed to be a balance in all of those things. How does family perceive one as father? How does a family perceive one as father? That becomes very important to understand. One thing is certain in our society today. Much confusion and even anguish stem from the conflicting demands made on the American father and mother. It's just a fact of life. We understand that. He, as a father, many times had been excluded from raising his children. We see this. And when they reach maturity and become too much for mom, he is expected to take over. Adolescent problems revolving around sex, drugs, and school many times are thrust upon dad, and many times he's ill-equipped to handle them. In many households until relatively recently, our history showed mother's principal role was the management of the house. Understandably, her operation ran more efficiently without the interference from the amateurs. I think you understand what I'm trying to say. And generally, if father's name was mentioned to the children at all during the day, it was to put the fear of God in them. It went something like this. Wait until your father gets home. It happened in my family. It happened in my father and mother's family. That's just the way that it was. Wait until your father gets home. And generally it worked. Joyce Brothers made a comment when she was still alive. She said, father is the one mother went to when she reached the end of her rope or wanted to avoid the unpopular decision. And dad was no less to blame for his peculiar position. He was perfectly content content man's error of omission, to be allowed to pursue his ambitions outside the household while at the same time experiencing the genuine comforts and joys afforded the family man. So we see all of these things happening in our society. You have to be cognizant of what we see going on around us and to understand God and Christ and understand his relationship with us as a father and a son and as our father to us as well. Let's ask another question. The importance of a father to a son, probably the most important or powerful example. Again, I'm going to quote from the book Father, the Figure and Force by Christopher Anderson. To any father who really cares about his children, nothing is of greater importance than their training for discipline and their instruction in principles. Together, these make up their character, which Aristotle defined as the deft decisions a person makes when the choice is not obvious. Christopher Anderson said, my father used to say, character is the way we act when nobody is looking. For example, it is no test of character to stop your car at a police roadblock. The test comes along when you are driving at 4 a.m. in the morning along a desolate back road in Illinois. You're heading toward a red light at an intersection, and you can see for miles around that there is nobody else on the road. Do you obey the law, even though there is no cross traffic, or do you zoom on through at full speed? He said this is a choice of character, made on the basis of respect for law, on the discipline of adhering to principles of safe driving. You decide to stop on the strength of character instead of responding to convenience or whim. But where does that such ingrained knowledge of right and wrong come from? Does it not come from a child who has learned to make those choices? And the job belongs to every parent in the family, especially, as he said, in a way that God has chosen the father of each family to set that example, to be his representative in the home as a part of that example. So Christopher Anderson points out the importance of the impartation of these things as children grow up. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 6. I want to read from Deuteronomy chapter 6, and you've read it many, many times, but let's go back and look at it one more time as we look at the concept that we're wanting to evaluate today as fathers, as I mentioned, who are to set an example for their children. This is chapter 6 and verse 1. This is Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 1. He said, this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land where you cross over to possess, that you may fear the Lord your God to keep all of his statutes and his commandments, which I command you, you, your son, your grandson, all the days of your life, that your days may be prolonged. Verse 3, therefore hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly as the Lord your God has promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey. Verses 4 through 7. Hear, O Israel, now he begins to talk about God's law. The Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, your soul, and all of your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. And then he talks about binding them for signs on your hands and other places. The point is very simply what we see. Verse 10, perhaps you haven't seen it in the context of the scripture, because in verse 10, it says, look to the fathers. In this case, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Notice what it says. So it shall be when the Lord your God brings you into the land of which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you a large and beautiful cities, which you did not build, houses, etc., etc. So the point is that we look at what the fathers, by example, have given. And I think the concept that what we see here is simply the example that needs to be set in teaching our children those qualities. The power of example. How about also how a son learns to treat women? How a son learns to treat women. How does he do that? How does he do that? Well, again, from Christopher Anderson's book. For his daughter, he says he is the model of what to expect of men. For his son, a dad is the first model of what to be. Even as adults, it is agonizingly difficult for us to separate the fathering role from the sexual one. Fathers also provided our first objective lesson in dealing with the opposite sex. Girls learn first how men are likely to treat them from watching the way dad treated mom. Interesting. The way dad treated mom. Boys also take their cue from father. If dad respects mom, if dad is understanding, if dad is honest, if dad is reasoned in his approach to her, a son is more likely to emulate those qualities when he grows to manhood. If dad is high-handed or overbearing or conversely timid and submissive toward his wife, it is obvious that mutual respect is not there. A son may carry these qualities into adulthood as well, or he may rebel against them. Want to take it one more step? The importance of a father to a daughter. This, I think, is very interesting. According to Dr. John Money, this is again from the book, sex roles are fixed by 18 months, and then a little girl has curls, she's wearing a dress, and she's already daddy's budding coquette. Women asked to search their minds for their earliest childhood memories invariably come to recollections of rubbing their baby smooth skin against dad's rough beard, or the smell, a crisp smell of his aftershave. I don't know which one that might have been, but back in those days we didn't have the $45 or $50 bottles, I'm sure, of the aftershave. A little girl's earliest impression of her father may exert a profound influence on the physical characteristics she seeks in a mate. For a girl, the father is the first figure. Until recently in society, father and other male relatives were a female's only real standard for judging the opposite sex. Girls saw their fathers far more than any other man right up to the time that they got ready to get married themselves. Daddy may have provided the model for what is to be expected of men, but he was also a symbol of power and authority outside in the outside world. For the most part, he dominated, not domineered, mother and the rest of the family, girls included, from the book said, they envied him. They envied him. Another part of fatherhood is how to deal and react toward men by a daughter. Listen to this one again from the same book. A father can be the first date, and in that way he can play a tremendously important role. Etta Leshin stated that when his daughter finally got her father to take her out to dinner, when they came back home, she ran up to her mom. And she said, Mommy, Mommy, do you know why a man is always walks on the outside when he walks down the street with a lady? Then she explained that in the olden days, the horses used to splash up mud so the men got dirty instead of the ladies. She was excited to tell this tidbit, but it was more than just trivia. For her, it was an introduction into the world of grown-ups. Who is better equipped to serve as a young woman's guide into that world than her father? That's from his book. I thought it was an interesting comment. Society views fathers not the way they used to. And Bruce Lockerbie made some comments, and I really don't have as much time to read it, but I just want to read a couple of concepts from it just so that you can see what we battle in the church today and the world that we live in and the struggles that we face. It's a little bit long. Please bear with me. It'll take a couple of minutes, but the title of the book is Father Love, Learning to Give the Best You've Got by Bruce Lockerbie. He said, being a father is difficult enough even with the loving support of a faithful wife and a mother. How much more difficult is it for men without women? And even in these cases, both parents are in the home a perplexing sense of being cut off from other people with their common problems and solutions. They sometimes trouble a father. For one man, this is a sense of distance from his wife and children comes about through her domination over the family. For another, his loneliness is self-imposed, fostered perhaps by a wrong-headed macho attitude or cultural misunderstanding of the father's proper role. Similarly, for women, their own father's unfortunate example may altogether color their attitudes toward men. For others, the propaganda and the politics of women's liberation movement may distort their understanding of marriage and the family. Very true today. The increasing clamor among homosexual men to be allowed to adopt children by homosexual women to produce their own offspring by artificial insemination suggests how far awry modern attitudes toward family structure have taken us. Some of these modern attitudes apparently are seen in popular representations of fathers. Judging from the weekly television programs, the unfavorable portrait of fathers remains a constant ingredient in drama and entertainment. The features of a father seen on television are often those of a simpleton or a lout, a stumble bum, and an incompetent, the object of his children's well-deserved disrespect. Domestic comedies may offer great varieties in the occupations of fathers, but these men, whether blue-collar workers or Wall Street bankers, are almost universally portrayed as nincompoops on television. Foremost among them stands Archie Bunker as the prototypical father in American culture. He's a bigot and a racist, a hypocrite and a chauvinist, and the foil for all of his wife's virtues, the dark corner into which the light of his daughter's liberal education must shine. On the whole, fathers have been subject to more than enough ridicule in Father Knows Best, my three sons, Sanford and Son, and All in the Family. What today's father needs isn't further abuse from smart alecks on television or feminists on soapboxes. Instead, every father needs encouragement to do and keep on doing what his heart tells him to do, what is right, to love his wife, to love his children, to teach his sons and daughters. Again, principles that you and I were talking about in the early part of the sermon. But in a world of cheap shots and characters demeaning to fathers, where is the man to find what he is searching for? I thought it was a profound article, and you can read the whole book if you would like to. I think it becomes very interesting. So for us, we know that God is our Father. Jesus Christ is the husband to Israel and his bride, the church. I think there are some final thoughts I will share in the sermon now. Many men find it difficult to match the emotion of their mates. Sometimes they cannot be what their partner wants them to be. Instead of looking at the whole man, assessing many of his good qualities, we have seen that people counterbalance the flaw that a man may have, and they concentrate on the missing elements, and they permit it to dominate their relationship. We ask these people, if you're married to a good man, is he good enough? If you're married to a good man, is he good enough? I think children, we need to support teaching our children. We need to support the head of the family as that authority, the primary responsibility in the home that we are looking at. And I know that has been assigned to men, but I read the concept and how much broader it is than some things that we taught 30, 40, 50 years ago. It is not to be popular to relate to the age-old biblical concept that God holds men accountable for leadership in their families. Children naturally look to their fathers for authority, and they should, as well as mothers, to be involved in their disciplinary parts. I think authority is going to be tested with children. Sometimes you might hear, "I didn't ask to be born, you know." And as Johnny Carson said, "Well, I sure wished I had known that before." So, what can you say? So fathers have their fears, their doubts, and sometimes they don't talk about some of the things that they have. But there are tremendous, tremendous, tremendous rewards that we see. And I think that we see that when you have your children and when you see them working toward so many things together with father and mother. I think those are very, very important. So I am going to end the sermon here because there's a whole lot more that can be given. But I think as you look at the importance of the rewards, as you look at the concept that we see, I think we simply have to go back and read what the book said and to look at what it is to be a father, to look at what it is to be a mother, to look at what we need to be working at, to understand what the society is doing to us. And as we observe, the Father's Day approach tomorrow, I think more than anybody else in the world, I think we understand the fatherhood of God. And as we understand the fatherhood of God and we try to impart that and we try to example that in our lives, I know, and you know, and we've seen by the good fruits that we see in this congregation, the people are really trying to develop that kind of relationship that we appreciate very much.